Support for the Splendid Table podcast provided by Muir Glen Organic Tomatoes, sun-sweetened, picked in late summer and canned the same day to preserve their fresh, vine-ripened flavor. Online at muirglen.com.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's an English Christmas. No Tiny Tim, but we have got the roast goose, the trimmings, and a man with an especially mellow approach to cooking. He's the Observer's food columnist Nigel Slater, and his book is The Kitchen Diaries, A Year in the Kitchen with Nigel Slater. Well, Santa's going to leave extra stuff when he gets a taste of our cheese picks for his snack plate. Cheese guy Steve Jenkins presides. Strangers with Candy star Emmy Sedaris counsels us on party etiquette, like stuffing your medicine cabinet with marbles for those guests who love to snoop. A beer fairy tale comes with a life lesson. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. Now, look, I'm not sure if you two celebrate Christmas, but if you were celebrating Christmas, where would you go?
Well, first, Lynn, let me tell you, Michael and I celebrate every holiday where there's food served and presents. So, yes, of course.
Why am I not surprised? Yes.
And oddly enough, our favorite place to go for Christmas in general is New Mexico, and specifically a place called Nopalito in Las Cruces, New Mexico.
That's the great chili capital.
Well, it is the chili capital. And of course, any time of year when you sit down at Nopalito and wonder whether you ought to have green chili or red chili atop your stacked enchilada, what the waitress is very likely going to suggest is Christmas.
Right.
Which means red and green chili together on top of your food. And nothing is more festive.
Do they have a particular specialty?
It's a classic, what they like to call their native foods menu. And by that, they mean this is New Mexican food. That means it's not Tex-Mex or Arizona Mex or California Mex or even Sonoran Mex. This is New Mexican food, which has an identity all its own, all pretty much centered around the chili peppers that are, in fact, the state vegetable.
And when you order chili at a New Mexican restaurant, you can be assured you're not going to get something with meat in it or beans in it or anything in it. It's just going to be pureed chili. If you want meat added to it or tortillas added to it, then you ask for that. But you just get a very plain, pure puree of red or green chili.
But it's utterly delicious. So what is the place like?
Well, it's very Southwestern looking, very comfortable, very cozy, kind of a mom and pop place. And Nopalito means little cactus. So there are little sort of cactus decors, inside on the walls, on the tables, but nothing overblown or fancy. It's a very, very simple place.
So what should you order specifically? What have you got to taste?
Well, I would get a stacked enchilada, which is as opposed to a rolled enchilada. In other words, it's several tortillas interlaced with your choice of either beef or chicken, topped with your choice of red or green chili, hopefully some melted cheese, and also, if you want to go deluxe, you get a fried egg on top as well. That's sort of the classic garnish for a stacked enchilada.
And my favorite thing there is their chili rellenos, because you're getting a big Jim New Mexican chili, and it's fresh, and it has this just divine vegetable flavor to it. It's lightly fried and stuffed with cheese, and of course you put Christmas on top of it, red and green.
And at the beginning of the meal, I have to say, one of the things I like best about Nopalito were the standard beginning of a meal down there is, of course, tortilla chips. And here you get it with both red and green salsa. Now, curiously, the green salsa is served hot, temperature-wise, but it's actually very mild.
Huh.
The red salsa is served cool, but it's very, very hot. And it's a great combo to go back and forth between them.
Oh, that sounds good.
You know, it's one of those restaurants. I don't know if this is the case with you. There's so many restaurants Michael and I eat at where after we have the rolls and butter, we could leave. I mean, that's fine.
Yeah,
and it's the same thing here with the tortilla chips and the salsa. You know, just give me that and let me sit there for half an hour and I'll pay the bill and leave.
Well, but we didn't.
No, we didn't.
I assure you.
Well, it sounds like a perfect place to go. Happy Christmas, guys.
Merry Christmas to you. Ho, ho, ho.
You know where to send our gifts.
Yes, exactly.
Good.
Jane and Michael Stern are authors of Two for the Road. Now, you can hear the Sterns right here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. You just go to the website, splendidtable.org. I have a confession to make. Right about now, I start feeling like a ping pong ball. That desire to run in about three directions at once to get everything done. Now, for the instant gift, get thee to a bookstore. There are three cookbooks that we've seen this past year that are hitting areas that we haven't heard much about. Now, each one is authoritative, and each one really looks good. The first one I'm thinking of is Cradle of Flavor. Now, this is about the foods of Indonesia, Singapore, and Malaysia, and it's by James Oslin. Second one is Into the Vietnamese Kitchen by Andrea Nguyen. And the third one is Memories of Philippine Kitchens by Amy Bessa. Now, I've put these all up on the website, so you can find them, you know where, splendidtable.org. And oh, by the way, while you're there, register for our free e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Every week, we send you a recipe along with some tips and the occasional gem of piercing wisdom. So you can find it on the website. It's all free. Sign up, splendidtable.org.
Gifts I'm preparing for some Christmas sharing, but I pause because hang in my stocking, I can hear a knocking. Is that you, Santa Claus? Sure is dark out, ain't the slightest spark out upon my clacking jaw. Who's there, who is it, stopping for a visit? Is that you, Santa Claus?
It's Christmas Eve. We've got the sounds of the little hooves on the roof, and then there's the big dilemma. What to leave for Santa? Now, some swear by cookies, but not I. Cheese is my pick. I think the old elf needs protein, and he needs really dynamite protein. Now, that expert of cheese and that man of firm opinions, Stephen Jenkins, is here to help us make a selection. So, Stephen, welcome back.
Oh, it's great to be back.
So, what should I leave for Santa?
I was thinking it's got to be something that is memorable. We don't want Santa just to have something that it's just filler. We want Santa to have a cheese that he's going to go back to the North Pole and tell all of his workers about.
You got it. You got it.
I was thinking, first of all, that splendid Swiss cheese that's called Tête de Moine, Monk's Head. It's a little drum that weighs about a pound and a half, pound and three quarters. And it's a raw cow's milk cheese with an enormous flavor. But what would be so cool is if we could put that Tête de Moine on the device that's made expressly for Tête de Moine. It's called a girole.
What is
that? And a girole means a machine that makes ruffles. What you do is just plop that drum of Tête de Moine over this spindle, this steel spindle, and then you put this little thing like you're rolling up a window on top of it, except you turn it horizontally rather than vertically.
Oh, yeah.
And it has a dull blade on the top that as you turn it around the top of the Tête de Moine, it creates friction and therefore ruffles of this extraordinary cheese that's one of my favorites for 30 years.
This is then a hard cheese, right?
It's hard, like a Swiss cheese.
Uh-huh. This sounds fabulous. What would you drink with that? What would you set out with that then?
Well, I'd probably put a quart and a half of scotch out for Santa and some ice.
Warm up him, the reindeer,
oh, yeah.
If
it's indoors, he ought to be eating bourbon. If you're putting it outdoors, it ought to be scotch. Bourbon indoors, scotch outdoors. Or is it vice versa?
Okay. All right. Now, that's one selection. What? I got another one.
The great, great Christmas cheese besides Stilton, is Vacherin Mondor, which comes from France and Switzerland. And Vacherin Mondor is a cow's milk cheese that's only made in the fall and winter and has become just the most important thing to serve at Christmas time for so many Europeans that are cheese lovers. And it's custard soft, and it's banded by a strip of bark that's Norwegian spruce that's indigenous to the area, and it serves to flavor the inside. Actually, it serves to hold the cheese together because it's so soft and runny, it would fall apart if it didn't have this piece of bark around it. And what we do is just skim off this sort of deer antler velvet rind on the outside and stick spoons in it. And, you know, I've always said that it's the second greatest cheese in the world after Parmigiano Reggiano.
So, Stephen, with this greatness, what would you serve?
I'd want to serve something spicy like a Gewürztraminer or something red and fruity and light like a Pinot Noir.
Okay. And another cheese, then?
I want something American. You know, Christmas time is Stilton time, and, you know, that's a real no-brainer. Everybody would want to serve Santa some Stilton. But I was in Paris last month at this huge international food show that comes around every 2 years. And the darling of this entire show was an American cheese. I was stunned. It was taken out of its context and put in the Hall of Champions, and there it was. It's the Rogue Creamery Smoky Blue that comes from these two guys that bought Igvella's plant in Central Point, Oregon, and just began to make blue cheeses. And the one that they call Smoky Blue sounded so weird to me before I tasted it, I just sort of went bleck, because it's a smoked blue. But I'm here to tell you, it is one of the most fascinating things I've tasted in my 30 years of doing this. They smoke this raw cow's milk cheese from raw Oregon cow's milk with Oregon hazelnut shells. And then they age it 90 days in a local cave. And this is Smoky Blue, and the Europeans are knocked out over this cheese. I couldn't believe it.
It does sound weird, but...
Sounds weird, but it is absolutely delicious.
So what to drink with this one?
Oh, my gosh, I don't know what I'd... Once again, I'd probably drink whiskey with it.
This sounds like a single malt scotch would probably be great with the
now
smokiness.
Now you're talking.
Okay. Hey, Stephen. Happy Christmas, and thanks for
your
suggestions. Steve Jenkins is the author of Steve Jenkins Cheese Primer. Now, you can find Steve's Cheeses for Santa on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're getting Steve's picks, check out our new food talk group that we've started on Gather.com. It's an online space to ask questions, swap recipes, and meet like minds. And it's simple. You head to splendidtable.org and you click on Food Talk. Coming up, the Christmas Diary of a British Cook and Amy Sedaris on party giving for fun and profit. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. It's Target now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. Online at target.com/SuperTarget. Imagine a Christmas without all the craziness, where maybe getting together with people and the food is central to the celebration. Well, British writer and food columnist Nigel Slater shares his very personal take on the holiday. Nigel first captured us with his autobiography, Toast, the Story of a Boy's Hunger. Well, now he brings us into his daily cooking life with his new book, The Kitchen Diaries, A Year in the Kitchen with Nigel Slater. Nigel, welcome.
Hello. Hi.
Nigel, could I ask you to read a particular section of the book? It's the entry that you made on December the 1st.
Certainly. December the 1st. It's the lights that get me in the end. The candlelight bouncing off the oh-so-carefully polished glasses on the table. The dim amber glow from the oven that silhouettes the golden skin of the roasting bird. The shimmering string of lanterns I weave through the branches of the tree. That and the carols that float from the radio, or those that I catch as I pass by the open doors of St. Saviour's. The food's good too, of course, especially Boxing Day lunch. The bread sauce, the mince pies and the pudding. And doesn't it all taste so much better when you put a taper to the candles? Some food looks better than others in candlelight. A bowl of shining consommé, the crisp skin of a roast goose, a slick of ruby-coloured cranberry sauce, a jelly studded with citrus fruit, all look quite magnificent when there are tea lights on the table. Call me sentimental, but I light the candles when we eat Christmas lunch, even if it's the brightest day of the winter. But there is so much to be done before that. There's a good 3 weeks of everyday eating before we roast the goose and pull the crackers. It's simply that the older I get, the more I love Christmas. Just writing the word December gets me going.
What made you want to do a food diary? Doesn't it become very self-conscious after a while?
Well, I think any diary, by its very nature, does become a little self-conscious. And how I started was really scribbling notes down in a notebook. I mean, I've always kept little brown notebooks that I'd jot down recipes, or I'd jot down the seasons of when something seems to be at its best.
Mm-hmm.
Quite often I forget, so I sort of scribble them down. And, you know, I've missed a few things over the years, things that have a very short season. And I suddenly think, oh, where's the gooseberries or where's the blackcurrants? And, of course, I've missed them. So by jotting them down, it was really a sort of aid memoir. And then I thought, well, maybe I'm not the only person that needs this. And that's how the Kitchen Diaries started, was as a scribbled notebook.
Well, I'm thinking about how you talk about it. You decide to roast a duck one night and you save the fat, and the next night you think, let's have a salad and then potatoes fried in the duck fat. Just the use of duck fat to me means celebration.
Oh, there is something about, I'm glad you mentioned duck fat, because there is something about certain foods at certain times of the year that, in fact, you can actually eat them throughout. But sometimes you just know the moment is right. And when it's cold outside and when all the lights are twinkling in the frost and you think, I've got that cold duck fat in the fridge, and suddenly the potatoes are there and they're frying in the pan with the fat. And it just is the right food at the right time.
So how do you prepare for Christmas? Is the big meal for you on the eve? Is it on the day? And what do you usually do?
Well, the big meal is actually on the day itself. Uh-huh. Christmas Eve, traditionally, in the UK, is fish pie. Now, I actually find fish pie, although it is incredibly delicious, it's also one of the most complicated things to make because you've got so many bits and pieces, and I've got enough to think about. So I do something very simple on Christmas Eve so that Christmas Day, I know that I've got my meal planned out. I do as much as I can the night before. And it is this slow build-up, this sort of day by day, over the week, getting the mincemeat ready or making the mince pies, maybe making the cranberry sauce a little bit early, so that on the day itself, there isn't that awful last-minute panic. You've got a feeling, well, actually, I've got quite a lot of this done, so I'm going to take it slowly, and I'm going to just enjoy cooking.
So what would the menu be?
Well, you know, I'm a recent comer to Christmas. I hadn't used to celebrate it very much.
Really?
And so, for me, all the traditional things, the roast goose or the turkey or a large piece of meat, I mean, quite often you have a joint of beef at Christmas here, or a piece of ham, I get a real kick out of eating those. I absolutely love them because I haven't had them for the last sort of half century. I just love them. And so my Christmas meal, the main meal of the day, does tend to be a rather traditional roast of goose with roast potatoes, which are essential. If I'm roasting, then there's going to be potatoes. And then there'll be greens of some sort. A sharp sauce, so an apple sauce or a cranberry sauce, something to take away from the richness of the meat. And then, if I can, lots of little sausages and bits of bacon and just savoury things to make it all just sing.
What happened that changed you after 50 years to make Christmas different for you?
Well, I'm never quite sure why I didn't enjoy Christmas as much as I thought I should. I mean, when I was a little boy, my mother died at Christmas, and I often wonder if maybe I felt I shouldn't be celebrating Christmas. Uh-huh. And it was only a few years ago that, for some reason, I decided that rather than avoid it and to do an alternative meal, I was going to take the traditional route, and I was going to have a tree, and I was going to dress it, and I was going to have the big bird, and do the whole thing that everyone else did. And I just changed my feelings about Christmas overnight. I suddenly realized the joy, the whole experience for me suddenly became absolutely crystal clear. The reason I wasn't enjoying it is because I wasn't doing the right thing. I wasn't getting it right.
Nigel, thank you, and a very happy Christmas to you.
Thank you, and happy Christmas to you too.
Nigel Slater's new book is The Kitchen Diaries, A Year in the Kitchen with Nigel Slater. Now, Nigel left us with his recipe for Christmas roast goose with juniper and apple and lemon puree and complete with homemade onion sauce. You can find it all on the website, splendidtable.org. So you haven't had a great idea for a party since the Clinton administration. Those urbane entertaining books just aren't doing it for you. Well, there is a book that could be your cure-all. Take a look at I Like You, Hospitality Under the Influence by Amy Sedaris. Now, Amy's a comedian, a writer, lately a movie star in her film Strangers with Candy. But what I didn't know is that she puts on the hostess apron, too. Amy, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Amy, how long did it take you to do this book? Because I have to tell you, each chapter could stand as a book unto itself. It's so packed.
It's so packed. It's everything I know. It took about a year and a half, and that includes taking the photographs in my apartment and getting all the illustration, all the artwork done.
And did you purposely sit out? Because all those photographs, especially the food photos, they all look like they're straight out of the 50s and 60s.
It was intentional. Well, a big inspiration was the old Betty Crocker, because that's what I grew up looking at. You know, my mom's cookbooks. The recipes weren't always that great in Betty Crocker, but the photographs were just amazing, and they always stayed in my head. So, like, I overcooked the beans to get that, you know, that army green, you know.
Yes,
so I just wanted to do things and just – I like to see the stitches on things, you know. So I just wanted it to have that scrapbooky, real feel to it.
Now, these are all your recipes? I didn't realize that you cooked. I guess that's...
I do cook a lot, but they're easy recipes, ages, you know, 3 and up. And a lot of them were my mother's or someone in my family or friends that, you know, I'm like, oh, I love that recipe for Cornish hens. Can I have it? And they're just everything that I've made at one point or I've had at one point.
You know what I love? I think you are single-handedly bringing back the cheese ball.
Hey, that was my goal. When I moved to New York, I'm like, where are all the cheese balls? You know, where's Hickory Farms? But that's a perfect thing to bring to someone's house.
And you can put anything you want in it, so it doesn't
matter. Anything. It's like meatloaf. You're just cleaning out the refrigerator. Roll it in some nuts, you're good to go.
Now, a big part of the book is you get into the psychology behind your parties. So how do you decide who to invite?
Well, to me, it's really the guests that are going to make your party. I mean, you really have to cast your party. And there's a person that I refer to as the barnacle in the book, and that's someone who always brings people down. They might as well have a big anchor on their T-shirt. And they just come, they enter the room complaining. They contribute nothing to the party. They don't mingle. They just, you know that person. Everyone's got one.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's fine if you want to entertain the barnacle on a one-on-one situation. But don't, you know, invite them to an affair with six or less people, because no one's going to want to come to your your house again because they're going to think that barnacle's there. You know, invite them to a larger affair. Well, chances are there's another barnacle there and they can hook up.
You know, so many times the barnacle is someone in your family and you don't have a lot of choice about having them. Yeah.
Well, luckily, I don't have that problem. A lot of people have talked to me about that. So I'm always like, I don't know what to say. Get something in pill form. I don't know. I'll give you my dealer's number.
So what about guest etiquette? What, aside from showing up and really showing up and knowing you're there for a purpose, what else should we be thinking when we're invited?
Well, again, like I kept that in mind, like people who entertain already know all that information. It's not anything new. But for people who don't entertain, I think it's important for them to know what we go through and how to be a good guest. And I think a major one is do not come 15 minutes too early. That just throws everything off. Because, you know, if you entertain, you plan it down to the last minute. You know, you're waiting for a sauce. You could be waiting for a pill to kick in. You couldn't get a shower. Whatever it is, we have timed it. We're organizers. We prepare. And so when you show up early, we hate you. You know, we hate your guts or a dish, a surprise dish. You know, we've already planned the menu. We don't need a three-story chocolate walnut yogurt cake. You know what I mean? Or show up with something that's going to you need counter space or refrigerator space. Or say, oh, I'm going to go ahead and chop the vegetables here. I need a chopping block and a sharp knife. No, no, we don't do it at home. You know what I mean? And I have a thing about flowers, you know, especially to larger affairs. Just don't bring them because we have to accept them, chop them down, find a vase, find counter space. And meanwhile, that's just taking us out of circulation, I think.
One thing you talk about, which I can't wait to do this, is to put marbles in your medicine cabinet.
Or pennies, yeah.
Or pennies.
Yeah, and then you load it up so when someone opens the medicine chest, they'll fall out and it'll make a huge noise. It's hilarious when it happens. Or put an eviction notice on someone's door. Like, I have a fake eviction notice, and so if I go to someone's house, I'd like to put it on their door, and they have no idea it's there till the next morning.
You like to take people out of their comfort zone, don't you?
I do. I love to do that. Or I like to make money. And I set up a display table at all my parties where I'm trying to get rid of stuff, like half bottles of lotion or old CDs or tapes, anything.
Uh-huh.
And it's 25 cents. And that way, that'll pay for my laundry. And usually people will buy it. You know, no one wants to leave empty-handed.
You know, it's a lively end to a party. I think this is a neat idea. Hey, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, and thank you for having me.
A very happy holiday.
Happy holidays to you.
Fat man's coming, fat man's coming.
Amy Sedaris is author of I Like You, Hospitality Under the Influence. Now, of course, you have got to try one of Amy's cheese balls. You can find Cluster Haven's peppermill cheese ball, you know where, guys, on the website, splendidtable.org. Beer historian Alan Eames will go anywhere and do almost anything to experience an unheard of beer in its native setting. I have Alan on the phone. Alan, it's good to have you back.
Great to talk with you again.
Now, I understand that you've been working with fairy tales?
Yes. Amazingly enough, beer forms a substantial part of all fairy tale literature, Western European.
Huh.
From Russian to Hans Christian Andersen, Andersen created this wonderful character called the Bog Witch, who brews, and women would tell their children, come to the window, see that? And they'd look out the window at the fog rolling in off the moors, and that's the sign the Bog Witch is brewing. But I found, and it took me 3 years, from three different sources to piece together the greatest fairy tale ever about beer. And it essentially is the story of a young girl, youngest of five sisters, all of whom are beautiful and talented and intelligent, but the last. And her parents despair of ever marrying her off. They don't know what to do with her, so they take her to an abbey where the abbess and the nuns are famed for making great ale.
Uh-huh.
And they say, please take our daughter, teach her a trade, teach her how to brew. Otherwise, what are we going to do with her? Okay, the abbess agrees to do this. And within a year, it is apparent not only is this brewster talented, but she's inventive. She goes into the forest, gathers mosses and mushrooms, and she's creating beers the likes of which no one has ever had. the abbess calls her to her side and says, young lady, we can teach you nothing. You are the mistress of all you survey in the world of beer. So here's the deal. We're sending you home. Set up a little beer shop. You'll be fine. But take with you this firkin of Christmas ale that you brewed. And good luck, because it's a six-week hike through the dark forest. And our young Brewster, on day six, finds herself schlepping this barrel through the forest, thinking, this thing is too heavy. I wish there were somebody I could meet that I could talk with and drink with, lighten this load. She comes around the corner, and there is this exquisitely tall, platinum blonde-haired, deep blue-eyed old man with this radiant white robe, and he says to the young Brewster, well, how are you, my dear, and what's that? She said, oh, it's my Christmas ale. Do you like ale? And this creature responds, I love ale. I'd love to drink some of that. Well, she said, let's sit down and drink. But before we do, who are you and what do you do? And he says to her, I am the creator of all. I am your heavenly father. The Brewster amazes him when she stands up and says, look, I'm not going to drink with you. He said, why not, my child? She said, I don't like the world. I don't like the way things are run. I don't like the way the innocent suffer. I'm out of here. And leaving an astonished god, she goes on. 2 days later, she's thinking, this thing is still so heavy to carry. I wish there was somebody else. She turns the corner, and there's this guy dressed in red in a cloak, and the whole place reeks of sulfur. And he says, good day, miss, and what's that you've got? Oh, it's my Christmas ale. He says, oh, I love ale. I'd love to have some ale. It's so hot. I'm so thirsty. She says, well, let's drink some, but before we do, who are you and what do you do? He said, well, I'm the lord of the lower realms. She said, you mean you're the devil? Yes, my child, I am, and he has his place in the universe, too, so let's drink. She said, no, I don't like the way you bring sorrow and discord to the world. I'm not going to drink with you. To hell with you. And off she goes with her firkin.
Pretty smart girl. Okay.
So. Several days later, she meets a third person. Just as she's despairing of carrying this firkin, she comes around the corner. There's this tall, cadaverous creature dressed in black with a deep, charnel house voice. Good day, my dear, and what is that you carry? Oh, that's my Christmas ale. Would you like some? Yes, I love ale. I'm dry as a lime basket. Well, let's drink then. But before we do, who are you and what do you do? Well, don't be frightened, my child. I'm the angel of death. Wonderful. Let's drink. Well, just a minute, my child. Aren't you frightened of me? No. Why not? I like you. Why is that? Because you're fair. In this world, you take rich, poor, young, old, each in his time, you harvest them all, and I think that's great. So the Brewster and the Angel of Death spend the afternoon drinking, which then segues into another whole story we need not concern ourselves with. But the moral, the medieval moral to this wonderful tale is, I suppose, choose your drinking partners carefully.
Alan, thank you.
My pleasure.
Alan Eames is author of The Secret Life of Beer, and his story came from a Norwegian folktale. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. And since this is port wine season, the question is, what does port wine have to do with bad luck? Well, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at Target.com/SuperTarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I have got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, since this is port wine season, the question was, what does port wine have to do with bad luck? Well, the luck is in how you pass the port around the table. You always pass it to the left. Now, if you pass port to the right, it's going to bring bad luck to everybody. Now, this is from the proverbial horse's mouth, specifically a British butler named Stanley Ager. Years ago, he did a book called The Butler's Guide. Now, Stanley had all kinds of port information. The host, for instance, always pours the first glass for the person on his right, then passes the decanter to the left. Now, this gets confusing. The basic idea here is that you never pour port for yourself. Each person who gets the port decanter has to pour for the person on their right and then pass the decanter to the left. Another thing is that it is impolite to ask for more port. You are supposed to ask the holder of the port, "Do you know the Bishop of Norwich?" Now, if they're clueless, you say, "Well, you know, he was an awfully nice fellow, but he never remembered to pass the port."
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid.
It's time for your calls, brought to you by Muir Glen Organic Tomatoes, tomatoes true to nature. Okay, pick up that phone. Number's 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see. We have got Renee calling from Reno. Renee, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I have a question about chocolate cake. Uh-huh. And I don't know if I just can't find the right recipe or if I'm using the wrong ingredients. But I want one of those chocolate cakes like you get at the really nice restaurant that's really chocolatey and rich and dark and wonderful, not like the sort of like fluffy cake box type that you get.
Yeah.
That real dark, deep,
rich,
super wonderful chocolate cake like you get, you know, that's $8 a slice.
Yeah, okay. There's two things that occur to me right off the top of my head. One is, what kind of chocolate are you using?
I've tried a bunch of different kinds. I've tried the stuff you can get in the grocery store, and right. I've gone to the specialty shops and gotten the real expensive chocolate.
Okay.
And I don't know if the chocolate bar is better than the cocoa powder, but I guess there are different kinds of cocoa powder, too.
Well, the cocoa powder doesn't have fat in it.
Okay.
And one of the things you get when you get that luscious, you know, melting wonderfulness is it's using full chocolate because the cocoa is leaner.
Okay.
So, and the higher quality chocolate's going to be silkier. It's going to have more intense flavor. They're going to give you a lot of chocolate punch. The other question is, do you use an oven thermometer when you're baking?
No.
You should, because you know one of the things I think might be happening? Oven might be going too fast. It may be too high.
Oh, okay.
And you're actually overbaking.
Okay.
And so that's two things. But do you know where I would begin if I were you? I'd begin with brownies.
Okay.
Because if you think about what a brownie is about a lot of chocolate, some flour, and eggs. You know what a brownie is? A brownie is a baked pudding.
Okay.
But that's what you are talking about. Those big, dense cakes, those big chocolate-flavored, dense, creamy, luscious cakes are really about making a pudding, meaning lots of chocolate and eggs.
Okay.
With a bit of flour. Let me give you a starter idea, and then you can flavor this however you want. What I'm doing is an offshoot of the brownie. It just has less flour and more chocolate.
Okay.
Okay. This is all, if you can stir and melt chocolate, you can make this cake.
Oh, well, I can do that.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those, you can't kill it. Okay. The first thing that you want is, I think it's a 9-inch square, shiny cake pan. Shiny because a dark cake pan cooks too fast.
Okay.
All right. So you want a square.
Okay.
And you butter it and you flour it. And you want 10 ounces of chocolate, really good tasting chocolate. 7 ounces of that should be bittersweet.
Okay.
3 ounces unsweetened.
When you do a little unsweetened with bittersweet, you get a lot of punch.
Okay.
Okay? You want to melt that with 5 ounces of butter. Now, what that really is an entire bar of butter plus another 2 tablespoons.
Okay.
Okay? Put that in a bowl, put it over water, put it in the microwave, but gently melt it.
Okay.
All right? Let that cool. And then in a bowl, okay, you are going to beat together about 5 eggs and whatever you like in flavoring. I like a lot of vanilla, like a tablespoon of vanilla.
I love vanilla.
Vanilla is wonderful. 1 1/3 cups of sugar, okay, mm-hmm. A generous pinch of salt, and those 5 eggs, and you're going to beat that together. Now, one of the things I add to my chocolate to just heighten the flavor is I take instant espresso coffee, and I make like almost a syrup, maybe 2 heaping tablespoons of coffee and about 4 tablespoons of hot water. I melt it. And if you want to throw that in, you can. You don't have to.
Okay.
But so you can flavor this any way you want. You can put cinnamon in it. You can put orange in it or whatever. But the idea is that that's your base right there, and then 1/3 cup of flour that you beat into this mixture. All right?
Okay.
So you've got a bowl with the eggs, and you've got the flavoring and the sugar, and you've got the flour in there. And then the next thing you do is you stir in that chocolate that you melted.
Okay.
With the butter.
Okay.
You stir that. Don't overdo the stirring. You just want to thoroughly blend it.
Okay.
And you pour that in. Now, you should have your oven at 350. Always preheat the oven, by the way. Give it
right.
at least a half hour.
Okay.
And what you want, you can do, if you want to get like fudgy little pockets in the cake,
mm-hmm.
you could break up another chocolate bar and you can just stir that into the batter before you put it in the pan.
Okay.
So it'll melt as you bake. So you get these pockets
really
of melt. I mean, it's like chocolate on chocolate on chocolate. And then you want to bake that about 25 minutes
okay.
or until when you insert a knife, like within an inch of the rim, it comes out with just a few streaks on it. It's going to look a little fudgy.
Okay, so maybe just, it might look maybe a touch underdone from what
that's
I
That's it.
Okay.
And the center might even be still a little underdone. Don't
okay.
worry about it. You're going to cool it in the pan on a rack for about 30 minutes.
Okay.
Okay?
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah, and then you can serve it with maybe vanilla ice cream. And then you can put whipped cream on it, and you can just keep going on and on and on.
Oh, yeah. That sounds just – and this is the healthy low-fat recipe, right?
This is the healthy low-fat recipe. Hey, you know what? If you don't do it at this time of year, you're not going to do
you
it.
You got it. Yeah. I mean, this is the time to do it, right?
Serve everybody poached fish and then give them dessert.
That's right. Thank you so much.
Thank you for bringing back my recipe once again.
Okay.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Call us, 800-537-5252. We have got Kelly calling from Oklahoma City. Kelly, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I have a friend who is living in Jeddah, and he came back for a visit and left me a kilo of vacuum-packed half dates, and I have no idea what to do with them.
Vacuum-packed what dates?
H-A-I-F. It's probably just
maybe
the
it
brand
is the,
name.
It might just be the brand name. Are they fresh dates or are they dried?
Well, they're vacuum packed, but there's a lot of goo in there.
Well, they may actually be fresh dates.
I think they might be fresh.
So it's a question, what do you do with them?
Yes, I've never made anything with dates.
You can bake with them. There's the date nut bread. And, you know, you can take dates and wherever you have any other sweet fruit that's called for in a quick bread, you could substitute the dates.
Okay.
So that
That'd
would
be good for Christmas.
They would be great for Christmas. But there are some traditions with dates in the Arab world that are wonderful. For instance, in Morocco, you do a date and orange salad, where you cut out wedges of fresh orange and you cut pieces of the date. There's a pit in the center. You mm-hmm. cut that away. And you can toss that with fresh lemon juice and
okay.
And a bit of paprika, believe it or not, and a little bit of olive oil and black pepper. It's just delicious because the acidity of an orange, even though it's very sweet,
mm-hmm.
really just works with this almost creamy, intense sweetness of the date. It's a beautiful contrast.
I can't wait to taste them.
I think you're going to really enjoy them. There's another thing, too, that's really wonderful to do. If you can get salted, pitted, or shelled pistachios,
mm-hmm.
stuff them with them. And when you bite into them, you get that salty, delicious pistachio flavor.
Oh.
And then the date. And one other tradition is also roasted almonds. and dried apricots, which have that bittersweet quality, get stuffed inside that date.
I love apricots.
And, you know, it's the kind of thing you put it out at the holidays and people just go crazy because most people have never had these combinations.
Okay.
I think you've got sheer treasure there. 2 pounds, a kilo, you're going to have a ball.
Okay.
You're going to have a blast with them. What a wonderful gift.
Thank you.
You are welcome. You take care.
Okay.
Bye. Call us, 800-537-5252. We have got Louise calling from Studio City, California. Louise, what do you want to talk about?
Hello, and how do you do?
I do pretty well.
Thank you so much for hours of wonderful listening.
Thank you.
Your radio style is just fabulous. Okay, so my question from the past, many moons ago, I've been cooking about 50 years, I used to cook rice pudding on top of the stove with a quart of milk and a fourth of a cup of rice.
Right.
And you cook that for about an hour and then add an egg and vanilla if you like.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't get thick anymore. Is it the wrong rice?
What kind of rice did you use many moons ago? A long grain?
I can't remember what I had for lunch yesterday. I don't know.
I love it. There is, here's the deal with rice. There are different starches in different rices. So short grain or medium grain rices tend to give you a very creamy result, like the kind of result you'd want for a rice pudding.
Short grain, you say?
Yeah, short grain or medium grain. Now, some of the rices that have names that are those short grain or medium grain are things from Italy like Arborio, Canarole. But a lot of supermarkets just sell medium grain rice. And if you look closely at the label, depending on where you live, you might find it. Also, a lot of Asian rices fall into this category.
Wow,
you know, something called sticky rice is going to give you a really thick rice pudding because there's this starch that's released as it's cooked that just, you know, produces all of these wonderful gelatinous, sticky kind of rice grain. But try first the medium grain, and if that doesn't work, increase the rice.
Thank you so much.
Have a great holiday.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. You can call us at 800-537-5252. We've got a call that's coming to us through our discussion group at food.gather.com. It's Nevin from Washington, D.C. Hey, Nevin, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well.
Excellent. Well, I'm calling because I have a seasonal quandary.
Yeah?
Every year, my Uncle Peter makes a batch of lemon curd, which he gives out as gifts to all of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the great Christmas traditions in my family. And it's kind of sacrilegious to make or purchase lemon curd at any other time of year. So what I'm wondering, is there a way to kind of get a curd fix without kind of specifically making lemon curd? Are there any more kind of exotic curds out there? I've seen lime curd in the store before.
Well, I've seen curds made from almost any kind of fruit you can imagine. I've seen grapefruit curd. I've seen passion fruit. And passion fruit would probably be great by the way, for people who don't know what we're talking about, essentially what lemon curd is a custard. But what it's made with is lemon juice, sugar, butter, and eggs. And you can spread it like jam. It is the most delicious. It's just wonderful. And the idea that you get it every Christmas, I'm very jealous. This is one of the things you miss out on when you're Italian. You know, from lemon curd, my family does not know. But the thing about lemon curd that I love is the snap, the tartness of it against the richness of the eggs and the butter. And, you know, passion fruit has that same kind of tartness. It's not quite as tart, but it has that snap to it. But anyway, I'm trying to think now. I have seen orange. I've seen all the citruses. And I've seen passion fruit. And I saw mango at one point. I don't know how these taste.
Wow.
But I think once you've got the formula of, you know, how much butter, how much sugar, how many eggs, then you can add whatever fruit you want. The only thing you want to make sure of, because with sweeter fruits, you'd probably want to either use less sugar or you'd want to use some lemon along with the fruit to make sure that it has that, you know, it's not overly sweet. But I think you could do a curd out of anything, but the great traditional curd is lemon curd.
Of course. Now, my question would be then, if you do a passion fruit, which I think is a phenomenal idea.
It's a fabulous idea.
how much passion fruit juice would you put in? Like, or would you include some pulp?
Well, personally, I would love to do the pulp, but I do know. First of all, I've seen some organic box-packed passion fruit, you know, exotic fruit juices that are unbelievably good. They taste fresh, and it might be a good shortcut if you can't get good passion fruit. But I think this is, I mean, if you think about an average lemon curd recipe is something like, I'm just thinking off the top of my head, okay? Maybe 2 cups of sugar, maybe the juice of 3 large lemons, maybe some of the zest, and anywhere from 6 to 12 eggs, and about 6 to 8 ounces of butter. Now, there's lots of variations on that. But I would say the juice of 3 large lemons is at least 3/4 of a cup or a cup. Now, with the passion fruit, I think I'd do a cup. And I'd throw in the juice of a lemon along with it. So at least a cup. And one of the nice things is that you can add the eggs a little bit later and you can taste. You know, you don't want to taste it with the raw eggs before the eggs are cooked. But as you blend it together, you can taste and see if you need more. And remember, when it's cooled down or it's at room temperature, it's not – when it's chilled, it's going to be muted. But at room temperature, it's going to be pretty true to whatever you're tasting when it's warm.
Great. Well, Lynn, thank you so much. I'm glad to be able to continue this tradition without defying the family.
Would you give this to Uncle Peter at Christmas?
I would. If he's lucky enough.
You take care, and thanks for the call.
Hey, thank you, Lynn. Have a great holiday season.
You too. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 or go to food.gather.com. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Have a fine holiday. And until next week, let me leave you with this observation from Dave Barry. He said, in the old days, it was not called the holiday season. The Christians called it Christmas and went to church, and the Jews called it Hanukkah and went to synagogue, and the atheists went to parties and drank. People passing each other on the street would say, Merry Christmas, or Happy Hanukkah, or to the atheist, look out for that wall. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Now, everything you heard here today, solutions for life's little problems and so much more, can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek. Now, you can also download our weekly podcast. You can sign up for it online, splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is supported by Muir Glen Organic Tomatoes, sun-sweetened, picked in late summer, and canned the same day to preserve their fresh, vine-ripened flavor. Recipes online at muirglen.com. Muir Glen Tomatoes, true to nature. Our producers are Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell, with intern help from Alexis Donath. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week. Join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.